भासते स्वयं लिख्यते कथम हृदय कुहर मध्ये केवलं ब्रह्म मात्रम् यहम् अहमिति साक्षात् आत्मरूपेण भाति हृदि विष मनसा स्वम् चिन्वतामज्जता पवनचलनरोधात् आत्मनिष्ठो भवत्वम् देहं मृण्मयवच्चडात्मकम् अहं बुद्धिर्न तस्यास्त्यतो नाहं तत्तदभावशुक्तिसमये सिद्धात्मसद्भावतः कोऽहं भावयुतः कुतो वरधिया दृष्ट्वात्मनिष्ठात्मना सोऽहं स्फूर्तितया अरुणाचलशिवः पूर्णो विभाति स्वयम् सोऽहं स्फूर्तितया अरुणाचलशिवः पूर्णो विभाति स्वयम्
प्रणाम्स टू एवरीबडी ओम नमो भगवते श्री रमणाय ओवर टू यू माइकल जी
Namaskaram. Om Namo Bhagavate Sri Arunachala Ramanaya. Today I've been asked to talk about who am I, as taught by Bhagavan Ramana. I've been told that most of you will have are familiar with the teachings of Advaita, but some of you may not be so familiar with Bhagavan's teachings. Bhagavan's teachings are the purest form of Advaita. But what is unique about, there are several unique features about Bhagavan's teachings. The most important is the emphasis he put on practice. So that is what I will be emphasizing most today. I won't go through the basics in so much detail because I think the basics we're all familiar with. That is the entire philosophy and practice of Advaita Vedanta can be summarized in just four words: Deham, Naham, Koham, Soham. These are the opening lines of the third of the three verses from Muktika Treya that Pratibha just recited. Deham, the body; Naham is not I. Koham, who am I? Soham, I am he. Deham Naham is the... We must first have a preliminary understanding. In order to find out what we are, we first need to understand what we are not, because otherwise we'll be investigating the wrong thing. So long as we take ourselves to be this body, if we try to investigate ourselves, we'll be investigating the body. And body here doesn't mean just the physical body, because we are all aware of ourselves as I am this body, but when we're aware of ourselves as I am this body, this Dehatma Buddhi, it's not just the physical form that we take to be ourselves, it's all the panchakosas, all the five sheaths. That is the a physical body is the anamaya kosha. Then there's a pranamaya kosha, the life that animates this body. And manamaya kosha, the mind, which here in this context means the grosser functions of the mind, perceiving, remembering, thinking, emotions, and all these, that is, yeah, all the grosser functions of the mind. The vijnanamaya kosha is the intellect, the buddhi, and anandamaya kosha is the will, that is the chittam, which consists of all the vasanas. So these five collectively we now experience as ourself. So when ego is described as the dehatma buddhi, or the false awareness, I am this body, body in this context refers to all these five. These are not I. So we need to first understand that these are not I, because otherwise we'll be trying to investigate one or other of these five she's, or something associated with these five she's, rather than the I who is aware of itself as I am these five she's. So we first need to understand this body is not I. Then koham, who am I? That is the actual practice. And soham, that is the final experience. That is when we know what we actually are, we will know, but we are nothing other than that. We'll know the truth of the Mahavakyas, Tatvamasi, Aham Brahmasmi, Shivoham, Soham. Well, they're not, Shivoham and Soham are not Mahavakyas, but they're the implication of the Mahavakyas. So the actual practice is Koham, who am I? Some people take the practice to be meditating on the thought, I am he, Soham, or meditating, I am not this, I am that. I am not this body, I am that Brahman. But this is meditating like that is a mere thought. We cannot remove our ignorance merely by such a superficial thought. It's just an idea. Now, our experience is, I am this body, but it's such a deeply rooted experience. Throughout the waking and dream states, we always experience ourselves as being limited to these five sheaths. So we cannot get rid of this just by the thought, I'm not this body, I am Brahman. Because or even by reasoning why I am not this body and why I am Brahman, even that, because these are all activities of the mind and the intellect, which are functions of they're functions which belong to the five sheaths. So in order to know what we actually are, we need to investigate ourselves. So the practice that Bhagavan taught is the practice of self-investigation, that is actually investigating ourselves, not merely considering, it's not merely the reasoning. The reasoning is necessary as a prerequisite. First, we need to understand why we are not this body. But once we've understood that we are not this body, we're not any object. That is, all these five sheaths are objects perceived by us. Though we mistake them to be ourselves, this body is clearly an object. We can see it. It's clearly an object. The prana is also an object. We're aware of the breathing, the heartbeat, all these physiological functions. The mind, likewise, all the perceptions, the memories, the thoughts, the feelings, and so on, they're all objects perceived by us. The functioning of the intellect, the reasoning, the judging, discriminating, these are all things perceived by us. They're all objects. Even the will in its subtlest form is the vasana, the inclination. Those inclinations give rise to likes, dislikes, which in turn grow into desires and aversions, and which give rise to hopes, fears, and so on. So, and attachments and so on. These are all the will. Again, it's all these are objects perceived by us. But we are not any object. We are the subject. So we need to withdraw our attention from all the objects by fixing it on the subject. This is actually, as Bhagavan made clear, it's a very, very simple path. But many people at first have difficulty grasping, how do I investigate myself? Because we are so used to attending to objects, when we're asked to attend to a subject, we're looking for some object which we take to be the subject. But obviously, anything perceived by us, any object, anything that appears and disappears, cannot be what we actually are. So we need to attend to the subject. What is the subject? The subject is ego. Ego is a false awareness of ourselves. That is, as I said earlier, as ego, we are always aware of ourselves as I am this body consisting of five sheaths. This is a false awareness of ourselves, which we can clearly understand by considering our experience in the three states. Now we experience ourselves with this body. But in dream, we also experience ourselves as I am this body, but the body we experience as ourselves in dream is obviously different to this body. This body may be injured. That body may be perfectly healthy, or vice versa. We may have had some injury in a dream. When we wake up, our body, if this body is fine. So the body in dream, that is the anamaya kosha that we take to be ourselves in dream, is different to this anamaya kosha. And likewise, the pranamaya kosha and everything. But we may think, okay, it may be a different body, but the mind is the same. But even that, though it seems to be the same mind in both waking and dream, in sleep, we are aware of ourselves without being aware of any of these five sheaths. We're not aware of the mind. We're not aware of the intellect. We're not even aware of our likes, dislikes, desires, and so on. All we are aware of in sleep is our own existence, I am. The one thing that is continuous in all these three states is our fundamental awareness of our own existence. That is what we are aware of as I am. I am I am means I exist, and it implies that we're aware we exist. So I am refers to that fundamental awareness of our own existence, which is what is called Sat-Chit. Existence, awareness. So this alone is what is real. This is what we actually are. So this is what we need to investigate. So, but when we write, ego is the same fundamental awareness I am mixed with adjuncts. That is all the five sheaths that we take to be ourselves. These are adjuncts, upadis. But we now conflate with ourselves. We mistake these upadis to be ourselves. So in the process of investigation, we are not to, and because ego is this conflation of I am and the body, that is Sat-Chit and upadis, it is called Chit-Jada-Granti. Chit refers to Sat-Chit, the fundamental awareness of our own existence, or pure awareness. Jada refers to this body. That all these five sheaths are jada. They're all objects perceived by us. They have no awareness of their own. What is aware is ego, which is aware of itself as I am this body. So ego, whereas all objects are jada, ego is a mixture of chit and jada. So ego is the only, even ego is a thought, as Bhagavan said. In Sanskrit, he referred to it as aham vritti. In Tamil, as nanenum nimibu, the thought called I. So ego is a thought because it's a mixture of the reality, Sat-Chit, and this body, which is just a thought. So as such, ego is a thought. But unlike all other thoughts, ego is the only thought that is endowed with awareness. So ego is a mixture of chit and jada. So it's called Chit-Jada-Granti. It's the not formed by the entanglement of chit and jada. Of course, chit itself is never entangled. It is unaffected. But as ego, we are aware of ourselves as I'm this body. So it seems to us, we seem to be a knot between the pure awareness chit and this body. So when we are investigating ourselves, what we are investigating is not the jada portion of ego, it's only the chit portion, the awareness. So how do we investigate ourselves? If we want to investigate anything else, we depend on some instruments to know, for example, to know the thoughts and feelings in our mind. We at least need a mind to, as an instrument to know those things. To know physical objects, if you want to investigate physical things, if we are a scientist trying to investigate subatomic particles or the behavior of subatomic particles or distant planets or whatever, firstly, we need our five senses. Because it's only through the five senses that we're aware of the seeming existence of an external world. And then we need other instruments. We may need microscopes or telescopes or what they have in CERN, that particle accelerator, and all these things. So many instruments are required to investigate things. Or if we're, say, historian, how do we investigate history? We go through all the records, the books which have been written, the records available. If it's in the 20th century, we also have films and so on. So history is investigated through all the records. Or any investigation, we depend on things other than ourselves to know it. First, the basic thing we require is we need a mind to know anything other than ourselves. Secondly, to know anything outside this mind, or seemingly outside this mind, anything in the outside world, we need our five senses. And then we may need so many other instruments. But to know ourselves, we don't need any of these instruments. In fact, none of these instruments can help us to know ourselves. What is the one basic tool that we use in any inquiry, whether we're inquiring about subatomic particles or distant planets or distant periods in history, whatever it may be, the basic tool of any investigation is attention or observation. To know ourselves, the only tool we have is our attention or observation. We have to attend to ourselves. Metaphorically speaking, we have to look at ourselves. Instead of looking at other things, instead of attending to other things, we have to attend to ourselves. But as I said, this is an extremely simple part, because what is the one thing that we are always aware of? We're always aware I am. So we can always, that is, at all times and in all circumstances, we can investigate ourselves. But because we are so accustomed to attending to objects, and all objects, even the subtlest of objects, even the thoughts and feelings in our own mind, they are relatively gross compared to that fundamental awareness I am. So because of our familiarity with attending to gross things, to objects, it may seem difficult at first. I can't find any, some people say, I search, but I can't find any I. The I that says I can't find any I is the I who it should be attending to. So it is a subtle part, but if we think deeply about it and we understand the teachings correctly, then it will become clear to us what is meant by self-attentiveness. So there is never a moment when we are not aware of ourselves. We are always aware I am. But though we are always aware I am, we generally overlook this because we are so much interested in other things. Because of our interest in other things, we attend to things other than ourselves, and thereby we neglect I am. So we are always self-aware, but generally we are negligently self-aware. So in order to investigate ourselves, we need to be attentively self-aware. So we can describe the practice as being attentively self-aware or simply being self-attentive. How to be self-attentive? Plenty of clues and pointers have been given, both by Bhagavan and in older texts. So we need to think deeply about these pointers and attend to that for which they are to that at which they are pointing at us. For example, one pointer that is given in the Upanishads is tattvamasi, you are that. Many people, they reason about it. What does it mean? What does tattvamasi mean? What does tat mean? What does tvam mean? And they there's so much philosophical debate about it. And then there's disagreement between the Advaitins and Vishishta Advaitins and the Advaitins about what is the meaning of Tattvamasi and everything. This is all missing the whole point. The whole point is Tat means, it refers to Brahman or to anything that we are seeking. If we are seeking God or we're seeking happiness or we're seeking knowledge, that is Tat. And what is that Tat? Tvam. It is only you. So when we are told you are that, what should our response be? Oh, if I am that, then who am I? Now I seem to be this little person, but now I'm told I'm that infinite Brahman. So then what am I? So we need to, as soon, the purpose of the Mahavakya, Tattvamasi, is to turn our attention away from external things, away from the idea of Brahman as some very vast thing, some very abstract thing, or absolute reality, whatever we may call, however we may describe Brahman, to turn our mind away from an idea of Brahman back towards ourselves. Because what is Brahman? Brahman is only I. Aham Brahmasmi. There's no Brahman other than I. So to know Brahman, all we need to know is who am I. So we need to investigate ourselves. So these are all in the Upanishads, the Brahma Sutras, the Bhagavad Gita, and in so many other Vedantic texts, there are so many pointers. And Bhagavan has given us particularly deep and pertinent pointers. If we understand the implication of these pointers are not given to us just to have some nice philosophical discussion. This is given, all these pointers have practical implications. And it is the practical implications of these pointers given in these ancient texts that have been highlighted by Bhagavan in his teaching. That is, since we are that, what do we need to investigate? We need to investigate only who am I? We need to investigate. All we need to do, we can forget about Brahman, because Brahman, after all, for us now, Brahman is just an idea. Or even God is just an idea for us. We don't actually, we don't know Brahman as it is, and we don't know God as he is. We cannot know without knowing ourselves, because what is Brahman? Brahman is only ourselves. What is God? God is only ourselves. So we need to know what we are. So we need to investigate ourselves. We need to stop looking outwards. We need to look within to find out who am I. So we need to turn our attention away from all other things by turning it towards ourselves. In yoga, for example, what is the aim of yoga? Yoga's chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga is the restraint of the chitta vrittis. So in yoga, there are so many practices, pranayama and other associated practices, by which the yogi withdraws his mind, his or her mind, from all objects, from all thoughts, and thereby brings about a state of quiescence of mind. And if they go far enough, that leads to a state of manolaya that they call nirvikalpa samadhi. But that is not the means to know oneself, because we subside in a state of manolaya every night when we fall asleep. Sleep is nothing but a state of manolaya. Why do we fall asleep? We fall asleep because we are too tired to continue attending to things other than ourselves. So we withdraw our attention from all other things, and thereby we subside in sleep. Ego is not thereby annihilated. Likewise with nirvikalpa samadhi, by means of pranayama or other techniques, the attention is withdrawn from all other things, and the mind subsides in laya. But that is not the solution. The laya is only it's a temporary respite from thoughts. It's not a permanent solution. So as Bhagavan says, if a mind subsides by means of pranayama, it will remain subsided for a while, but it will again rise. As soon as the prana becomes active, the mind will also become active, and it will wander under the sway of its vasana. Bhagavan says in Nana, in the eighth paragraph. So merely withdrawing our attention from other things is not sufficient. In order to know what we actually are, we not only need to withdraw our attention from all other things, we need to attend only to ourselves. This is what the practice of self-investigation is. In fact, we don't even need to worry about withdrawing our attention from other things, because if we attend only to ourselves, if we focus all our attention on ourselves, it's automatically withdrawn from other things. If, for example, we are traveling in a train, there may be so much noise going on around us, but if we're reading a very interesting book, or if we're watching a video or something on our mobile, we because of our interest in what we are looking at, we won't notice all the noise and hustle and bustle going around. The train may stop at the station. We know our station is at the end of the line, so we won't be bothered about what stations we're passing. We're only interested in our book or whatever we are doing. So when our attention is on one thing, it's automatically withdrawn from other things. Likewise, if we focus our attention on ourselves, automatically, to the extent to which we attend to ourselves, our attention is thereby withdrawn from other things. So all we need to do is to attend to ourselves. That's why in another part of Nana, the sixth paragraph, Bhagavan says, Etene enengal erinomena. However many thoughts arise, so what? That is, we don't have to be concerned about thoughts, because if we, then in the next sentence he says, as and when thoughts arise, it's necessary to investigate to whom is this thought. Bhagavan isn't asking us to ask for question, to whom is this thought. That is, whatever thought may appear. Thought means not only the thoughts, and that according to Bhagavan, the whole world is nothing but thoughts. It's all this is a dream, so everything is just a thought. So whatever phenomenon may appear, to whom does it appear? It appears only to me. So whatever may appear, we can turn our attention away from that back towards ourselves, the one to whom it appears. So that is a very powerful clue that Bhagavan has given us, to whom. So there are times in our life when, for example, there may be very worrying thoughts in our mind, or we may be bereaved or something, or some very painful thoughts there. And how do we extricate ourselves from those thoughts? The simple way is to turn our attention away from the thought back towards ourselves, the one to whom it appears. So this is a very, very powerful clue that Bhagavan has given us. So, doesn't matter what appears or what disappears, to whom does it appear? We turn our attention back towards ourselves. So Bhagavan's teachings were entirely focused on this very simple practice of self-investigation. And as Bhagavan made clear, there is nothing easier than this. If we can attend to thing, to attend to something other than ourselves requires a movement of our mind away from ourselves towards that other thing. Our attention must go towards that thing. But in order to attend to ourselves, no movement of our mind is necessary. Our attention just has to remain in its source. We just have to attend only to ourselves. So the attention is not moving away from ourselves, but just resting in ourselves. So this is not attending to anything other than ourselves is an activity, whereas attending to ourselves is a state of just being, summa irapadu, as Bhagavan often said in Tamil. It's a state of just being. And that's why in Tamil Vedantic literature, the ultimate teaching is said to be summa iru, just be. But how to just be? So long as we're allowing our attention to move towards anything else, that's a mental activity. So in order to just be, that means to be without activity, we need to attend only to ourselves. This is the essence of Bhagavan's teaching. But though Bhagavan said this is, and though Bhagavan clearly explained why, this is extremely simple. When we try to put it into practice, we all feel, oh, this is very, very difficult. Why does it seem, when it's actually so easy to attend to ourselves, there cannot be anything easier than attending to ourselves, but why does it seem to be to us to be so difficult? The reason is that we have very strong vishaya vasanas. Vishaya vasanas means, vishaya means any object, any phenomenon, anything other than ourselves. Whatever appears and disappears is a vishaya. And vasana means an inclination. We have strong inclinations to attend to things other than ourselves. why are our inclinations to attend to other things so strong? Because attending to other things is the very nature of ego. As Bhagavan says in verse 25 of Uludhanapattu, that I'll first say in verse 24 of Uludhanapattu, what Bhagavan says is, Jada Ulunana Nadu, in sentient body, does not say I. When he says does not say I, that's obviously a metaphorical way of expressing it. The body is not aware of itself as I. Why is it not aware of itself as I? Because it's Jada. So, and the body here, as I said earlier, it means all the five sheaths. None of the five sheaths have any awareness of their own. So the body consisting of these five sheaths is Jada. And then in the next sentence, he says, Satchit Udiyadu. Satchit doesn't rise. That is, Satchit is ever as it is. It never undergoes any change. So there's no rising for Satchit. But between these two, Udalalava, Nan Ondru Udikum Ideyo. In between, that means in between the body and Satchit, one thing, I, rises as the extent of a body. What does he mean by saying in between? Obviously, Satchit is Brahman, one infinite whole. Nothing can be other than Satchit. So when he says in between, he's saying in between in a metaphorical sense. That is, this I that rises between the body and Satchit, it's in between in the sense that it is neither the Jadodal, the insentient body, nor is it Satchit, but something that partakes of the properties of both. For example, if you've read a story in the newspaper and you ask your friend, is this story true? Your friend may say to you, It's not entirely true. It's neither true nor false. It's somewhere in between. What do they mean by saying it's somewhere in between? That implies it's got elements of truth in it. It's got elements of falsehood, of fiction in it. So it's neither entirely true nor entirely false, but a mixture of truth and falsehood. Likewise, when Bhagavan says that this one thing I rises between the body and Satchit, he means it is neither this, what this I that rises is neither the body, because it's aware of itself as I, the body is not aware of itself as I, nor is it Satchit, because Satchit doesn't rise. But though it is neither the body nor Satchit, it borrows the properties of both. Like Satchit, it's aware of itself as I am. But it's aware of itself not just as I am, it's aware of itself as I am this body. That's why he says Udalalava, as the extent of a body. So this the I that rises, that is ego. So this ego, it is neither the body, nor is it Satchit. It's some spurious entity that rises between, taking the properties of both, limiting itself to the extent of a body, but taking the, borrowing the its existence and awareness from Satchit. And then he says in the next sentence, the conclusion of the verse, this, referring to this one thing I that rises, this is Chit-Jada-Granti. I've explained that term already, the knot between, because it's neither Chit nor Jada, it's a knot that is formed when they're entangled together. It's Chit-Jada-Granti, bondage, because it's only when we rise as ego and thereby limiting ourselves as this body that we seem to be bound. It is Jivan, Jiva. Jiva is nothing but this false I that rises between the body and Satchit, and limits itself as the extent of the body. Nupame, the subtle body. Ahande, ego. Ichamsara, this samsara. That there's no samsara other than ego. Manam, the mind. So this is the nature of ego. And then in the next verse, verse 25, he in the last line of verse 25, he describes ego as Uruvatra Payahande, a formless phantom ego. The reason he says it's a formless phantom is that it is formless because it has no form of its own. And it's a phantom because it's got no substance of its own. It borrows its form from the body and it borrows its substance from Satchit. But the ego itself is a formless phantom. So what does he say about this formless phantom? In the first line, he says, Urupatri undam, grasping form, it comes into existence. Urupatri nikam, grasping form, it stands. Urupatri undu mika ongam, grasping and feeding on forms, it flourishes abundantly. Uruvittu urupatram, leaving form, it grasps form. That means leaving one form, it grasps another form. So grasping form is the very nature of ego. Whatever form ego grasps is something other than itself, because it itself is a formless phantom. The first form that ego grasps is this form of five sheaths called body. So as soon as we rise as ego, we project and take a body to be ourselves. And so long as we continue to stand as ego, we continue to experience this body as ourselves. And not only do we grasp the form of this body, having grasped the form of this body, we're then aware of so many other forms. So attending to form the other forms is what he refers to in the third sentence, Urupatri undu mika ongam. Grasping and feeding on forms, it flourishes abundantly. That is, the more we attend to things other than ourselves, the more we are feeding this ego and it's becoming fat and strong. So what is the solution? The solution he gives in the next sentence, Tadinal otum pidicum. That means, literally it means, if sought, it takes flight. What does that mean? That is, we seem to be ego only so long as we're attending to things other than ourselves, only so long as we're grasping form, grasping things other than ourselves. In other words, attending to things other than ourselves, we seem to be ego. But if we try, instead of grasping other things, if we try to grasp ourselves, if we try to see who am I, ego then has nothing to hold on to, because it itself is a formless phantom. So when it tries to hold itself, it will subside and dissolve back into its source. That's what he means by otum pidicum. It will take flight. It will run away. So this is a crucial clue Bhagavan gives us. That he explains the nature of ego. And the whole problem we face is ego. So the nature of ego is to rise, to come into existence, stand and flourish, grasping form. But if it tries to grasp itself, it will subside and disappear. So what is the means to get rid of ego? Only to, not to hold on to other things, but to hold on only to ego, to attend only to ego. So this is a very vital clue that Bhagavan gives us. The more we attend to ourselves, the more ego will subside. And ego, as he explained in the previous verse, it is a mixture. Or it is chitta granti. It's a mixture of that satchit and the jada upadis, adjuncts, this body. So the more we investigate ourselves, that is, the more we investigate the chit portion of ego, the more our attention is thereby withdrawn from all other things, and hence the upadis drop off to the extent that we hold on to that fundamental awareness of our own existence, I am. The more keenly we attend to I am, the more the adjuncts will drop off. And eventually, when we attend to I am keenly enough, so keenly that we thereby withdraw our attention from all other things, the adjuncts drop off entirely because we're no longer attending to them. And what remains is satchit alone. When ego experiences itself as satchit, that pure awareness, I am, it thereby ceases to be ego, because what is ego? Ego is nothing but the adjunct mixed awareness. So when it's aware of itself without adjuncts, that is being aware of itself as it actually is. As soon as it's aware of itself as it actually is, it ceases to be ego and remains as pure awareness. So what is it that is to, what is it eventually that knows itself? It is only satchit knows itself. But satchit always knows itself. So in this spiritual path, there is nothing to be gained. The spiritual path is not a path of acquiring anything. It's a path of tyaga, of giving up everything. We have to when we let go of all that is unreal, what is real alone remains. And how to let go of what is unreal? only by clinging to what is real. And what is real is only I am. So this path of self-investigation is not only the path of jnana, this is also the path of self-surrender. We are surrendering ego by investigating it. So this is the pinnacle of the path of bhakti is to surrender ourselves completely to God. How do we surrender ourselves completely to God? Only by investigating this ego. When we investigate ego, it takes flight. And thereby we surrender ourselves to God. So this is the path of complete renunciation and of complete surrender to God. So this is not just the path of jnana. This is the pinnacle of the path of bhakti. Because in order to surrender ourselves completely, we must have great love to do so. And so long as we are... I came to this point by talking about Vishayavasana. The Vishayavasana is the inclination to cling to other things. Because the very nature of ego is to cling to forms, the Vishayavasana is ego's inclination to cling to form. So long as our vasana, our Vishayavasana is strong, it will seem to us to be difficult to hold on to I am. We try to hold on to I am, but very quickly our attention gets diverted away towards other things because of the strength of our Vishayavasana. So how do we weaken our Vishayavasanas? Only by persevering in this very simple practice of trying to be self-attentive, trying to hold on to I am and I am alone. To the extent to which we hold on to I am, we are thereby not allowing ourselves to be swayed by our Vishayavasanas. And when we don't allow ourselves to be swayed by our Vishayavasanas, they are thereby weakened. So the means to weaken the Vishayavasanas, and the Vishayavasanas are the impurities in the mind. So in other words, the means to purify the mind, the most effective means to purify the mind, is to hold on to I am. Because by holding on to I am, we are thereby weakening the Vishayavasanas. Since the Vishayavasanas are the impurities in the mind, the way to purify the mind, the way to attain chittasuddhi literally means purification of the will, because the vasanas are the impurities in the will. So the purification of our mind or will is achieved simply by holding on to I am. So this holding on to I am is a path of jnana, the path of atma-vichara. It's also the path of bhakti, the path of atma-samapanam, giving ourselves wholly to God. Because what is God? God is that which is ever shining in our heart as I am. So by holding on to I am, we are holding on to the feet of God and surrendering ourselves completely to him. So that's a brief overview of the core principles of Bhagavan's teachings. And as I said, the main thing about Bhagavan's teachings, his teachings all, that is, Bhagavan wasn't so much concerned about the philosophy. Of course, he could explain things philosophically, but the philosophy is useless if we don't apply it in practice. So the primary focus of Bhagavan's teachings is on the practical application of the philosophy. The philosophy is important, but we shouldn't stop with the philosophy. We have to, how do we apply this philosophy in practice? The simple way to apply it in practice, tatvamasi, since you are that, who am I? Holding on to this I. This is the practical application of all that is taught in all the vast ocean of Vedantic texts. How to apply them in practice? Simply by attending to ourselves. As Krishna said in Gita, atma samstam mana kritva, fix the mind on self alone, na kinchit api chintaya, do not think of anything else. We don't even have to worry about not thinking of anything else. So long as we fix our mind on atma, we are thereby withdrawing our attention from all thoughts. So the thoughts will drop off and atma alone will remain. Om namo bhagavate sri arunachala ramanaya. Do any of you have any questions to ask about this or about any other aspect of Bhagavan's teachings?
This is Vedavyas from Nashville.
Yes.
Does it require a faith that if you are the pure consciousness and it's that you have to be pure and good within, If you keep discovering or digging deeper and deeper, you will find the pure consciousness. You will become pure, or you'll become a clean slate. Does it require some faith to get started?
A certain amount of faith in the sense of trust is necessary for any undertaking. Supposing you want to become a scientist or a doctor or something, you have to go to university and you have to study. At first, you have to take a lot of what you're told on trust. You can't test every finding, you can't repeat all the experiments that have been done before. We take things on trust. So in this path, naturally, we have to have trust in the guru's words. But Bhagavan doesn't merely ask us to believe his words. What he says is very reasonable. He points out an analysis of our own experience. If we analyze our own experience, we understand how what he's pointing out is actually our own experience. That is, we ourselves, though we seem to be this body, when we think deeply about our experience, we're aware of ourselves without this body in dreams. So how can this body be what we actually are? And we're aware of ourselves without the mind in sleep. So how can this mind be what we actually are? So it's perfectly reasonable what he teaches us. So, but of course we need some minimum faith, some trust. As we do in any, if you don't trust anyone, we read the newspapers, we see the news on the television. We trust what is being reported is true. I mean, we hear, for example, about the evacuation of Kabul, but we weren't there. We weren't seeing that. It could all be just a drama. It could all be something concocted just for some political propaganda or something. But generally, we take it. It's reported by so many reliable news channels. We take it on trust. So many things in life that we think we know, we actually take them on trust. So exactly the same in the spiritual path. When we start on the spiritual path, there has to be a certain degree of trust, but very minimal trust. I mean, because this is based on our own experience of ourselves. So we don't actually, less faith is required in this path than in, for example, believing the news that we read in the newspaper. That requires a lot of faith, because we know often these news channels may have, their reporting may be biased. They may be just showing one side of it. So, but still we believe them with some reservation. But in this part, because this is based on our own experience, some faith is obviously necessary, but the faith required is very minimal. But what is required is faithfulness. Faithfulness in the sense of we need to be very dedicated to this. We can't dabble in this and dabble in that and dabble in that. Like the old analogy is given. If you want to find water, you need to dig one deep well. Choose a place to dig and start digging. Don't dig 5 feet here and 5 feet there and 5 feet there. You're not going to get water anywhere. You need to dig 50 feet in one place and you'll find water. So we need to be faithful to the guru in the sense that we need to be like a faithful husband or wife who is faithful in that relationship, that is, they're dedicated to one. Likewise, we need to have such Guru Nata, the Lord our Guru, we need to be faithful to him. We need to follow, take one set of teachings and follow those teachings faithfully. In that sense, faith is definitely required. We shouldn't be, because if we allow our mind to fritter, to try a little, read this teachings and that teachings and this, our mind is getting scattered and we're not going deep. In order to succeed in the spiritual path, whatever spiritual path we choose to follow, we need to go deep in that path. So we need to be faithful. We need to be dedicated to that one alone. Does that adequately answer your question?
Thank you. There was one other Yes. One other concern is that this glimpses of your true nature being pure.
Yes.
You get glimpses, but how do you stay in that true nature? How do you stay in your true nature?
Yes. When it is said we get glimpses, we never actually, that is, we are always aware I am, but we are always, so long as we rise and stand as ego, that is, throughout the waking and dream state, we're aware of I am mixed with adjuncts. But the more we practice this simple path of Atmavichara, self-investigation, the more we attend to ourselves, the more clearly we become aware of ourselves as something distinct from these adjuncts that we now take to be ourselves. So in that sense, we become more clearly aware of ourselves. We have attained a greater clarity of self-awareness. But it is only when we lose ourselves completely in that that infinite clarity of pure awareness that we actually know what we are. That is, we as ego, we can never know what we actually are, because as ego is a false awareness of ourselves. So ego cannot know pure awareness, because pure awareness can never be an object known by ego. But as ego, we need to try to experience ourselves with pure awareness by attending to ourselves alone. As soon as we succeed in experiencing ourselves with pure awareness, we thereby cease to be ego, because we remain just as pure awareness. So we know what we actually, as ego, we now are trying to know ourselves as we actually are. But as soon as we know ourselves as we actually are, we thereby cease to be ego and remain as we actually are, as we always actually were. That's why I said there's nothing new to be achieved. We just have to give up everything unreal, and what is real alone will remain.
There is a question by Hemant. How do you know you are making progress on this path?
Bhagavan said, the only sign of progress is perseverance. If you are dedicated to this path, if you are sincerely trying to follow this path, you are definitely making progress. It is not easy to see our progress, because the more we follow this path, the purer our mind becomes. But the purer our mind becomes, the more clearly we become aware of the impurities. Sadhu Om used to give an analogy. If you see a crescent moon, you can't see any craters. If you see a half moon, you can vaguely see some slight craters. It's only in the full moon that you can see the craters very clearly. So the brighter the moon becomes, the more clear the craters become. Likewise, the more pure our mind becomes, the more clearly we become aware of the impurities. So it may seem to us, I'm not making any progress at all. In fact, I'm worse than I was. I wasn't such a bad person before, but now I seem to be a really bad person. That is because of the increasing purity of our mind, we become more painfully aware of even the slightest impurity. You can also, another analogy we can give, if you've got a t-shirt that is full of so many stains, the whole thing looks muddy. It's all been, you've been running through mud and the whole thing is muddy. But you can't find the more deeply rooted stains. But if you begin to wash it, then you remove the more superficial dirt, and the more deeply ingrained dirt becomes more obvious. So likewise, the deeper we go in this path, the more our deeply rooted impurities become clear to us. So that is why, if you read the poetry of great saints, like Bhagavan has sung Arunachal Stuti Panchakam, or saints like Manika Vasaka, or so many great saints have sung in so many Indian languages, Sanskrit and all regional languages, there are saints who have written heart-melting prayers. You will find one thing that is common to all of them. They all describe themselves as the worst of the worst of the worst. Bhagavan, in one verse, he sings, Paramanim Padum Patrarapatrum Paravari Variril Paraman. He's addressing Arunachala as Parama, O Supreme. O Supreme, I am the supreme among those who are destitute of the supreme wisdom to cling without attachment to your feet. So he's describing himself as the worst of the worst. And like that, you'll find that in the songs of, in the poetry of so many great saints, they talk about themselves as being the worst of the worst. Why is that? Are they just saying that? No, that is what actually they feel. That is, as the mind becomes purer and purer. Now, of course, Bhagavan sang that after he had attained everything, but he was reflecting the mind of a true devotee there by singing these hymns. So the more we pure our mind becomes, the more we are aware of our lack of wisdom to cling without attachment to his feet, the more we are become aware of our residual desires and attachments and vasanas and so on. So the purer our mind becomes, the more clearly we'll become aware of our impurities. So it's not easy to measure our progress, but Bhagavan said, perseverance is the sign of progress. Why is perseverance the sign of progress? Because perseverance is the sign of love. If we have bhakti, if we have real love to know and to be what we actually are, we will persevere in this path. If we are doing this only half-heartedly, if we're not, okay, I do a little bit of meditation now and then, but I'm not really, that shows the lack of our earnestness, the lack of our bhakti. So the most reliable sign of progress is the fact that we're persevering. We may seem to be failing time and time again. We're trying to attend to ourselves, but again, our attention gets distracted by allow ourselves to be swayed by our vishaya vasana. We fail so many times. Failure doesn't matter. What matters is that we try. So long as we are trying, the fruit of our efforts are in his hands. As Krishna says in Gita, you have the adhikara to the action, not to the fruit thereof. So we have all that we have been asked to do is to try to follow this path, try to investigate ourselves. The outcome we leave in his hands.
There's another question. Mm-hmm. What is from Pankaj? What is drawing attention to ourselves? Is it focusing on our breath or visualize the divine form? Chant mantras to keep the mind focused. Please advise.
All these things that you mentioned are things other than ourselves. The prana is the breath, is an object perceived by us. We are aware of the breathing. All the names and forms of God, whatever it may be, these are all objects. Our aim is not to, that is, it's good on the path of bhakti to meditate on in the preliminary stages of the path of bhakti. Meditating on a name and form is very good. But what God is the true nature of God is not any name and form. God is nameless and formless. So because we take ourselves to be the name and form of this body, it's appropriate for us. God seems to be something other than us, so it's appropriate for God to attribute a name and form to God and to meditate upon that with love. That is very good. But we need to go deeper. God is not anything other than ourselves. God is that which is shining in our heart as I. So we when we go deeper in this path, we need to leave behind name and form and try to investigate only ourselves. So attending to ourselves is not attending to a breath, it's not murti dhyana, it's not mantra japa, it's not attending to anything other than ourselves. It is, Bhagavan describes it in one place as ananya bhava, meditating on what is not other. That what is not other means only on ourselves. So we need to try, who is it who is aware of the breath? Who is it who is aware of the name and form of God? I am. So we need to turn our attention away from everything that is perceived, back towards ourself, the perceiver, away from everything that is known, back towards ourself, the knower. So attending only to the knower, that alone is self-attentiveness. Attending to anything that is known, any object, anything, any vishaya, is not, it cannot be self-attentiveness. As I say, this is very subtle, but if we think about it deeply and try to put it into practice, one clue Bhagavan gave to help people at the initial stages, he said, even if you go on thinking I, that will lead you to that point. What does he mean by that? When we say a word, for instance, if we say a word like Krishna, we something comes to our mind. We remember Lord Krishna who gave the Bhagavad Gita and the blue form and cowherd boy who was playing. We remember that is the word. Every word refers to something. So the word Krishna refers to that divine form of Krishna. Or if we say Shiva, it reminds us of Shiva. This is why Nama Japa is such a powerful aid, because by repeating the name of God, it's an aid to fix our mind on that which is denoted by that name. That is God. So, but rather than, since God is not something other than ourselves, God is that which is ever shining in our heart as I, the first and foremost name of God, Bhagavan said, is I or I am. So by repeating I or I am, that helps to, it's not just a matter of repeating the word. What does that word refer to? When we say I, it refers to that fundamental awareness of our own existence. So repeating the word I, not as a mechanical japa, we need to repeat the word I and try to attend to that to which that word is referring. When we say I am, what is it that is referred to by I am? It's our own existence. That can be a help at the early stages to familiarize ourselves with self-attentiveness. Because our aim is to attend only to ourselves, not to anything other than ourselves. Not to anything that appears and disappears, but that which is ever constant. That is our own existence, our own being. I am.
There's a question from Satish G. Does one need a guru to lead one in this path? If so, how to find a guru and get accepted?
Guru is absolutely necessary. Some people believe Bhagavan had no guru, but Bhagavan said, no, Arunachal is my guru. So guru need not necessarily be in human form, but guru can appear in a divine form. But in the case of Bhagavan, his guru is Arunachala. Arunachala seems to be a hill. That hill is Sakshat Shiva Swarupa. So Shiva himself in the form of the hill, that was Bhagavan's guru. Shiva himself appeared under a tree in Perundurai as Manikavasaka's guru. So a guru can appear in any form, but guru is absolutely necessary. However, what is the purpose of guru? Why is guru necessary? Guru is necessary to turn our attention back towards ourselves. That is, if we are devotees of God, if we are devoted to God, we want to know God. We want to reach God. We want to attain God. But God is not something other than ourselves. God is that which is always shining in our heart as I. So it's necessary for God to appear in the form of guru to tell us to turn within to know what we actually are. So guru is absolutely necessary. However, some people nowadays have a very gross understanding of guru. They think guru must be, they talk about a living guru. But that is, because they take it that guru must be a person, a body that is living. That's what they mean by living guru. When people ask Sadhu Om whether a living guru is necessary, he said, yes, absolutely necessary, but not a guru who is living one day and going to die the next day. The guru that is necessary is the ever-living guru. And that ever-living guru is Bhagavan, who is always shining in our heart as I am. So we shouldn't take merely the outward form of guru is not the only, the true form of guru is that which is always shining in our heart as I. The purpose of the outward form of guru is to turn us within. So for many of us, Bhagavan is guru. Bhagavan Ramana is our guru. That is, if we are attracted to Bhagavan's path, he is our guru. But Most of those who nowadays consider themselves to be devotees of Bhagavan, following Bhagavan, they weren't even born during his lifetime. I wasn't born. I was born in 1955, so 5 years after Bhagavan left his body. I mean, those who actually were in the physical presence of Bhagavan and remember having been in the physical presence of Bhagavan will now be in their mid-70s at the minimum. So slowly, slowly, they're dying out. But that doesn't matter because Bhagavan is not limited. One of the fundamental teachings of Bhagavan is, I am not this body. So Bhagavan is in no way limited to that body. When his body was, shortly before his body died, devotees were weeping and saying, oh, Bhagavan, you're going, you're leaving us. He laughed. He said, where am I going? I am always here. Because when he says, I am always here, we can take it in two senses. He's ever there in Tiruvannamalai because Bhagavan and Arunachala are one and the same. So he's ever present in the form of Arunachala. He's also ever present in the heart of each one of us as I. So there's no time or place where Bhagavan isn't present. So that is the true guru. Not just the person who is living one day and dead the next day. That is not the real guru. So Bhagavan gave us a very deep and refined understanding of what is guru. And what is the function of the outward form of guru? It's only to give us the teachings that we have to turn within. So even after 1,000 years, Bhagavan's teachings will still be available because he himself wrote Arunachala Stuti Panchakam, Uludunapadu, Upadeshundia, Nana. He himself wrote his teachings. So his teachings in their pure, pristine form are ever available to us. So if you want to find a guru, you cannot find any better guru than Bhagavan Ramana. He is Dakshinamurti himself. He is the Adi Guru, appeared in this human form in this modern age to teach us this simple path of turning within. So how to know the and he always emphasized God, Guru, and Self are one and the same. So it is our own self that we, so long as we limit ourselves to this body, our unlimited real nature appears outwardly as God. And that same God then appears in the form of Guru to tell us to turn within. And when we turn within, we then find that Guru is that which is ever shining in our heart as I, and is all, we are nothing other than that. So that is why the true Guru Bhakti is to give ourselves entirely to Guru by turning within and dissolving back into our source. So guru is absolutely necessary, but not the gross idea that people have of guru. Because gurus nowadays are two a penny. There are so many would-be gurus. Not only nowadays, there always have been plenty of people who are, it's much, much nicer to be a guru than to be a disciple. It's much easier to be a guru than a disciple. There, by guru in this context, I mean the false guru. There are so many people who are ready to pose as guru. Why do they do so? Because they are completely ignorant of what is the real guru. The real guru is not a human being. The real guru is Sakshat Shiva himself. That is, Dakshinamurti himself alone is the guru. So Dakshinamurti has appeared in the form of Bhagavan Ramana. So you cannot find a better guru or a simpler and clearer or more direct teaching than the teaching of Bhagavan Ramana. So if you ask my advice where to find a guru, Bhagavan is your guru. That is all I would say. If that doesn't appeal to you, you can. Not everyone. That is, why are there so many different spiritual paths? Why are there so many different religions? Because different people at different stages of their spiritual development, they have different needs. So some people are more attracted to the Dvaita philosophy and dualistic devotion. So there are suitable gurus for them. But if you're drawn to this path of complete surrender, of giving yourself entirely to God, the perfect guru is Bhagavan Ramana.
Can we take just one last question,
yes,
Michael?
Yes. Okay. I can go on as long as
the audience is not tired. Yes. The rest of the questions, you know, as it keeps coming, I will surely post it to him and get the answers and post it back to everybody. We'll just have this one last question from Matiji. Should we ignore thoughts and trust Bhagwan to guide us to function in the world? I probably would sort of modify this question, and because there was another question from another friend, how to sustain this self-attention throughout the day when we are involved in lots of activities?
Right. Yes. Well, the answer to the first question is yes. You can, Bhagavan says in Nana, however much burden you place on God, he will bear all of it. So we can give him even the burden of thinking for us. If we think of him alone means of I am, we are thereby surrendering all our burden to him. He will take care of everything else. According to Bhagavan, not only Bhagavan, the basic principle of Vedanta, our whole life in this world is preordained. It is according to prarabdha. Prarabdha is the fruit of actions that we've done in the past. So which actions would bear fruit when is in the hands of God. So God has selected certain fruit for us to experience in this lifetime. So all the pleasures and pains and ups and downs of life and everything, it's all been preordained for our own spiritual welfare. And whatever actions we need to do in order to experience our prarabdha, we will be made to do. So we can surrender our mind, speech, and body entirely to him. How do we surrender them entirely to him? By holding on to I am. Whether we hold on to I am or not, prarabdha is going to take its course. Things are going to happen as they're meant to happen. But if we hold on to I am, we are thereby surrendering ourselves and not interfering. If we, instead of surrendering ourselves to God by holding on to I am, we surrender ourselves to our vasanas and allow our mind outwards, we are then thereby doing agamya. Agamya is the actions which will bear fruit, which get stored in sanchitta, which will later be experienced as prarabdha. So we're free to do agamya, but whatever agamya we do will not change what we are destined to experience. What is destined to happen will happen. What is not destined to happen will not happen. Bhagavan wrote, when Bhagavan was a young boy, after he'd been about 2 years in Tirumalana, so he'd been about 18 years old in 1898, his mother came to know that he was in Tiruvannamalai. So she came to Tiruvannamalai and she was begging him to return with her to Madurai. He was, in those days, he spoke very little. He did sometimes speak, but generally he was keeping silent. Not for any particular reason, he just wasn't inclined to speak. So when she was weeping and begging him to come back and he was sitting there silent, the devotees who were nearby, it pained them a lot to see the mother weeping and begging her son to come back home. So one devotee said, Swami, if you don't want to say anything, please at least write a note. Please at least write a message for your mother. So Bhagavan wrote on that piece of paper, Avarava prarabdha prakaram adhikarnavan angangirindu archvipan. According to the prarabdha of each one, adhikarnavan, he who is for that means God, Angangirindu, being there, that means being in every place, being in the heart of each person, it implies, Atavipan will make them, literally means make them dance. In other words, whatever actions we need to do in order for our prarabdha to unfold, we will be made to do those actions by God. And then he said in the next sentence, Endram Nadavadadu, Enviachikanum Nadavadu. What is never to happen will not happen, however much effort you make. Nadapadu Entadeseyinum Niladu. What is to happen will not stop, however much obstacle you try to do. In other words, what is going to happen is going to happen. What is not going to happen is not going to happen. We are free to want what is not going to happen, or to want to avoid what is going to happen. We are free to want that So we've got Ichyo's Tantra. We are free to try to avoid it, to try to experience what we are not destined to experience and to try to avoid what we are destined to experience. So we've got Kriya's Tantra. But we have no freedom to change what is destined to happen. What is destined to happen, that alone will happen. So since everything is happening according to Prarabdha, we can happily surrender us mind, speech, and body completely to him by holding on to I am. What is destined to happen will certainly happen. What is not destined to happen will certainly not happen. So, but by surrendering to him, we are refraining from interfering. Our interference doesn't make any difference to what happens, but unnecessarily we thereby create fresh karma, which gets added to the already vast store of the fruits of past actions that are stored in Sanchitta. And then from which God selects a small portion for us to experience as Prarabdha in each lifetime. So we can happily surrender ourselves completely to God by holding on to I am. He will take care of everything. He will even do our thinking for us. So we need not. That's why Krishna said in Gita, Atma samstam matam kritva. Fix your mind in self. Na kinchit api chintaya. Do not think of anything else. If your mind is completely fixed in yourself, you will not automatically, your attention is withdrawn from other things, so you'll not be thinking of them. That is what Krishna said in that verse. That is chapter 6, I think verse 25 of Bhagavad Gita, the last two lines. That is exactly what Bhagavan taught us. That's all we need to do. Fix our mind on ourselves and do not think of anything else. He will take care of everything. The life will go on perfectly as it is meant to go on. Trying to do this or that, it doesn't make any difference. It just creates fresh karma unnecessarily. We render ourselves completely to him. There's nothing for us to worry about. He will take care of everything.